Chapter 68. I have lost all claim upon you, and I make no complaint. But I do say that, by coming back with me now you will show no less kindness to him, and escape any sound of shame. But I don't wish to escape it. If you don't on your own account, cannot you wish to on mine and hers? Nobody except our household knows that you have left home. Then why should you, by a piece of perverseness, bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave? If it were not for my husband, she began, moved by his words. But how can I meet him there? How can any woman who is not a mere man's creature join him, after what has taken place? He would go away again, rather than keep you out of my house. How do you know that, father? We met him on our way here, and he told us so, said Mrs. Milbury. He had said something like it before. He seems very much upset altogether. He declared to her, when he came to our house, that he would wait for time and devotion to bring about his forgiveness, said her husband. That was it, wasn't it, Lucy? Yes. That he would not intrude upon you, Grace, till you gave him absolute permission, Mrs. Milbury added. This antecedent considerateness in Fitzpiers was as welcome to Grace as it was unexpected, and though she did not desire his presence, she was sorry that by her retaliatory fictionness he had given him a different reason for avoiding her. She made no further objections to accompanying her parents, taking them into the inner room, to give Winterbourne a last look, and gathering up the two or three things that belonged to her. While she was doing this the two women came who had been called by Milbury, and at their heels poor Creedle. Forgive me, but I can't rule my morning noho as a man should, Mr. Milbury, he said. Hadn't seen him since Thursday se'nnight, and have wondered for days and days where he's been keeping. There was I expecting him to come and tell me to wash out the cider barrels against the making, and here was he. Well, I've knowed him from table high. I know his father used to bide about upon two sticks, in the sun afore he died. And now I've seen the end of the family, which we can ill afford to lose. Why such a scanty lot of good folk in Hintock as we've got. And now Robert Creedle will be nailed up in parish boards a bleef, and nobody will glutch down a sigh for he. They started for home, Marty and Creedle remaining behind. For a time Grace and her father walked side by side without speaking. It was just in the blue of the dawn, and the chilling tone of the sky was reflected in her cold, wet face. The whole wood seemed to be a house of death, pervaded by loss to its uttermost length and breadth. Winterbourne was gone, and the copses seemed to show the want of him. Those young trees, so many of which he had planted, and of which he had spoken so truly when he said that he should fall before they fell, were at that very moment sending out their roots in the direction that he had given them with his subtle hand. One thing made it tolerable to us, that your husband should come back to the house, said Milbury at last, the death of Mrs. Charmond. Ah, yes, said Grace, arousing slightly to the recollection. He told me so. Did he tell you how she died? It was no such death as Giles. She was shot by a disappointed lover. It occurred in Germany. The unfortunate man shot himself afterwards. He was that South Carolina gentleman of very passionate nature who used to haunt this place to force her to an interview, and followed her about everywhere. So ends the brilliant Felice Charmond, once a good friend to me, but no friend to you. I can forgive her, said Grace, absently. Did Edgar tell you of this? No, but he put a London newspaper, giving an account of it, on the hall table, folded in such a way that we should see it. It will be in the Sherton paper this week, no doubt. To make the event more solemn still to him, he had just before had sharp words with her, and left her. He told Lucy this, as nothing about him appears in the newspaper. And the cause of the quarrel was, of all people, she we've left behind us. Do you mean Marty? Grace spoke the words but perfunctorily. For, pertinent and pointed as Melberry's story was, as he had no heart for it now. Yes. Marty South. Melberry persisted in his narrative, to divert her from her present grief, if possible. Ever he went away, she wrote him a letter, which he kept in his pocket a long while before reading. He chanced to pull it out in Mrs. Charman's presence, and read it out loud. It contained something which teased her very much, and that led to the rupture. She was following him to make it up when she met with her terrible death. Melberry did not know enough to give the gist of the incident, which was that Marty South's letter had been concerning a certain personal adornment common to herself and Mrs. Charmond. Her bullet reached its billet at last. The scene between Fitzpiers and Felice had been sharp, as only a scene can be which arises out of the mortification of one woman by another in the presence of a lover. True, Marty had not effected it by word of mouth. The charge about the locks of hair was made simply by Fitzpiers reading her letter to him aloud to Felice in the playfully ironical tones of one who had become a little weary of his situation, and was finding his friend, in the phrase of George Herbert, a lad delight. He had stroked those false tresses with his hand many a time without knowing them to be transplanted, and it was impossible, when the discovery was so abruptly made, to avoid being finely satirical, despite her generous disposition. That was how it had begun, and tragedy had been its end. On his abrupt departure as he had followed him to the station, but the train was gone, and in traveling to Baden in search of him as he had met his rival, whose reproaches led to an altercation, and the death of both. Of that precipitate scene of passion and crime Fitzpiers had known nothing till he saw an account of it in the papers, where, fortunately for himself, no mention was made of his prior acquaintance with the unhappy lady, nor was there any allusion to him in the subsequent inquiry, the double death being attributed to some gambling losses, though, in point of fact, neither one of them had visited the tables. Melberry and his daughter drew near their house, having seen but one living thing on their way, a squirrel, which did not run up its tree, but, dropping the sweet chestnut which it carried, cried chut chut chut, and stamped with its hind legs on the ground. When the roofs and chimneys of the homestead began to emerge from the screen of boughs, Grace started, and checked herself in her abstracted advance. "You clearly understand," she said to her stepmother, some of her old misgiving returning, "that I am coming back only on condition of his leaving as he promised? Will you let him know this, that there may be no mistake?" Mrs. Melberry, who had some long private talks with Fitzpiers, assured Grace that she need have no doubts on that point, and that he would probably be gone by the evening. Grace then entered with them into Melberry's wing of the house, and sat down listlessly in the parlor, while her stepmother went to Fitzpiers. The prompt obedience to her wishes which the surgeon showed did honor to him, if anything could. Before Mrs. Melberry had returned to the room, Grace, who was sitting on the parlor window bench, saw her husband go from the door under the increasing light of morning, with a bag in his hand. While passing through the gate he turned his head. The firelight of the room she sat in threw her figure into dark relief against the window as she looked through the panes, and he must have seen her distinctly. In a moment he went on, the gate fell to, and he disappeared. At the hut as he had declared that another had displaced him, and now she had banished him. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.